From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
I think after 3 years of war on Iraq, we have to put a kind of evaluation for this war as Iraqis, because we can see that your media is telling you another stories about Iraq.
Two Iraqi women who've just flown into the United States tell their story. And come hell or high water, Hurricane Katrina and the color of disaster. We'll speak with Professor Michael Eric Dyson.
Hurricane Katrina revealed the convergence of race, class, and poverty in this nation, also the vicious politics of cronyism and the result of an administration whose belief is that the government is the enemy of the people.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Bush wrapped up his four-day trip to South Asia and Pakistan this weekend. The president ruled out a nuclear agreement with Pakistan, but praised Pakistani leader General Pervez Musharraf for his commitment to, quote, freedom and democracy. The Washington Post is reporting the Pakistani government cracked down on a planned rally against Bush's visit just hours before his arrival. 20 members of a small political group were beaten and arrested. A dozen of the party's leaders were also detained before the protest could grow in size. According to the Post, U.S. officials said President Bush is more concerned about Musharraf's help in the so-called war on terror than he is about Pakistan's record on democracy. In other news, Amnesty International has condemned what it calls the arbitrary detention of tens of thousands of people in Iraq. In a new report, the human rights group says the U.S.-run prison system has become, quote, a recipe for abuse. Amnesty International UK Director Kate Allen said, quote, as long as U.S. and U.K. forces hold prisoners in secret detention conditions, torture is much more likely to occur, to go undetected and to go unpublished. Meanwhile, The Washington Post is reporting a new study has found more than 90% of Baghdad residents suffer from psychological disorders such as insomnia, depression, and post-traumatic stress. According to the study, violent incidents have nearly doubled during the 3 years since the invasion than in the preceding 14 years. A mass exodus of educated professionals since the U.S. invasion has left the country with only 75 psychiatrists and no child psychiatrists at all. In Kenya, the UN is warning of a massive food crisis. The World Food Program says it's received just a tenth of the funding it needs to feed some 3.5 million people. A prolonged drought has had devastating effects. The agency says it's short nearly $200 million in food aid and has only enough supplies to last until the end of April. This is World Food Program's James Morris.
The crisis at hand is saving lives. The human body can't stand this much shock, especially if it has no nourishment and no water.
James Morris of the World Food Program. This news on Iran. UN Ambassador John Bolton has warned Iran of painful consequences if it continues to carry out nuclear activities. The International Atomic Energy Agency is expected to meet today on Iran. On Sunday, Iran repeated its threat to begin large-scale nuclear enrichment if it's referred to the UN Security Council. Meanwhile, the New York Times is reporting Iran's nuclear ambitions are being hindered by numerous technical problems. Citing interviews with several of the world's leading nuclear experts, the Times says obstacles remain, quote, at virtually every step on the atomic road. U.S. intelligence officials say it'll take 5 to 10 years for Iran to manufacture the fuel for its first atomic bomb. In Thailand, tens of thousands of protesters took to the streets of Bangkok Sunday to demand the resignation of the prime minister, Thaksin Shinawatra. Close to 5,000 police officers were placed at the rally, with another 5,000 on standby. Organizers have vowed to continue their protests until the prime minister agrees to step down. In Chechnya, the leader of a pro-Kremlin militant group has been appointed prime minister. Ramzan Kadyrov, who has served as first deputy prime minister, has been linked to several human rights abuses in the government's fight against separatist rebels. Kadyrov will officially take office in October when he turns 30 years old. Kadyrov is the son of former Chechenian president Akhmat Kadyrov, who was assassinated in 2004. Back in the United States, the Washington Post is reporting the Bush administration has launched a new campaign to target government sources and the journalists they speak to. According to the Post, the campaign includes several FBI investigations, polygraph testing inside the CIA, and a warning to prosecute reporters under espionage laws. The investigations have reportedly affected dozens of employees in different government intelligence agencies. In one media case, FBI agents and a federal prosecutor questioned a reporter at the Sacramento Bee newspaper. The reporter had cited sealed court information in articles about terror suspects. The Bush administration launched the campaign after leaks led to the publication of reports detailing the CIA's secret prison network and the National Security Agency's warrantless domestic spy program. New York Times executive editor Bill Keller said, quote, there's a tone of gleeful relish in the way they talk about dragging reporters before grand juries, their appetite for withholding information, and the hints that reporters who look too hard into the public's business risk being branded traitors. Meanwhile, the Washington Post has revealed one of its reporters gave the FBI back a secret document he obtained from a group who said it contained proof they were targets of the government's spy program. The reporter, David Ottaway, received the document from Saudi Arabia's Al-Haramain Islamic Foundation in 2004. The document had been mistakenly handed over to the group by the federal government. The Post finally broke the group's story last week when its Oregon affiliate filed a lawsuit against the government. The group says government records show the National Security Agency intercepted several of the group's conversations in the spring of 2004. Washington Post executive editor Leonard Downey said the government surveillance program was not known at the time Ottaway received the document and thus contained no useful information. In other news, a federal court order has forced the release of thousands of pages of documents containing the names and details of more than 300 current and former detainees held at Guantanamo Bay. The documents have been posted on the Pentagon's website. They contain the most detailed look yet at the Guantanamo prison population. In many cases, the charges against the detainees are being disclosed for the first time. The documents were released following a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit brought by the Associated Press against the Pentagon. In the documents, scores of detainees pledge their innocence and allege abuse at the hands of U.S. prison guards. In business news, telecom giant AT&T has reached a near $70 billion deal to purchase Bell South. Some analysts said the deal, if approved, would be the fifth largest merger in U.S. history. The Wall Street Journal is reporting analysts expect around 8,000 layoffs as a result. In other news, former Congressmember Randy Duke Cunningham has been sentenced to 8 years and 4 months in prison. Cunningham pleaded guilty last year to accepting more than $2.4 million in bribes from military contractors. The eight-term California Republican also admitted to evading more than $1 million in taxes and committing mail and wire fraud. In addition to his jail term, Cunningham was ordered to pay $1.8 million in restitution. Cunningham's corruption was so extensive, he even maintained a bribe menu listing his kickback prices. The sentence is the longest ever handed to a member of Congress in a federal corruption case. Cunningham served on the House Appropriations Subcommittee on Defense and was chair of the House Intelligence Subcommittee on Terrorism, Human Intelligence Analysis, and Counterintelligence. The Cunningham case has led to an investigation of one of the CIA's top officials, CIA Executive Director Kyle Dusty Fago, the third in command of the agency, is being investigated following reports he had close ties to a contractor who won Pentagon bids through his links to Cunningham. And convicted civil rights lawyer Lynn Stewart has disclosed she's battling breast cancer. Lynn Stewart was diagnosed in November and had a tumor removed earlier this year. Lynn Stewart was convicted last year of conspiracy and providing material support to terrorism by releasing a statement by her imprisoned client, Sheikh Omar Abdulrahman. She is facing a maximum of 30 years in prison, is scheduled to be sentenced next week. Her lawyers have requested sentencing be postponed until the end of July so she can pursue treatment. Lynn Stewart has always maintained that she is innocent of the charges that she was convicted of. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. as we turn now to Iraq. Nearly 3 months after a December election, Iraq's divided political leaders are still fighting over the crucial post of prime minister in the new government. The Iraqi president, Jalal Talabani, said Monday he would convene parliament in 6 days, but there's little chance of forming a unity coalition. Talabani is leading a group of Sunni Kurds and others opposing Prime Minister Ibrahim al-Jafri's bid for a new term amid anger over the recent surge of violence in the country. In the latest bloodshed, a car bomb in Bakuba, north of Baghdad, killed 6 people, 2 of whom were girls under 4 years old. As many as 1,300 Iraqis were killed the week following the February 22nd bombing of the Gold Dome of the Askariya Shrine in Samarra, one of the holiest sites to Shia Muslims. It marked one of the bloodiest periods since the U.S. invaded the country nearly 3 years ago. While the bloodshed appears to have at least temporarily subsided, the outbreak of violence last week has raised new concerns about where Iraq is headed and the prospect of an outbreak of an all-out civil war. But back in Washington, the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Peter Pace, was asked by Tim Russert on NBC's Meet the Press how things are going in Iraq.
You were to be asked whether things in Iraq are going well or badly, what would you say? How would you answer?
I'd say they're going well. I wouldn't put a great big smiley face on it, but I would say they're going very, very well.
General Pace's comments come as Amnesty International releases a new report condemning what it calls the arbitrary detention of tens of thousands of people in Iraq. In this new report, the human rights group says the situation has become, quote, a recipe for abuse. Amnesty International's UK director, Kate Allen, said, quote, as long as U.S. and U.K. forces hold prisoners in secret detention, conditions, torture is much more likely to occur, to go undetected and to go unpunished. Today, we'll talk about Iraq with Iraqis. This weekend, 7 Iraqi women arrived in New York City, or at least were supposed to begin a speaking tour to educate Americans about the reality in Iraq and meet with UN and U.S. officials to call for a peace plan. We will be joined by 2 of them. But before we go to them, I wanted to turn to Medea Benjamin, who is organizing this tour around the country, founder of Code Pink, Women for Peace. Medea, I said 7 women came into the country or were supposed to, because, in fact, only 5 made it.
2 of the women who we wanted to bring here were women whose entire families were killed by the U.S. military as they were driving in their cars to get away from the violence. The tanks came and shot into their cars. One woman talks about her little boy on her lap and seeing the bullet go right through his forehead, her other 2 children killed, her husband killed, and her left in the car with the bloody bodies. We thought it was important to bring these women to meet with Cindy Sheehan and other U.S. mothers who have lost their children. And yet, when these women went to apply for their visas, they were denied. When I called the State Department to find out why, they said they had no compelling family ties left in Iraq that would ensure that they would return home, so they were at risk of staying in the United States.
So they were denied entry into the United States because the U.S. military had killed their families?
They could not prove that they would want to go home. So, yes, we killed their families and then denied them the right to come to the United States to tell what the U.S. had done to their families.
So the 5 women who are here, what are your plans? Where are you going starting today?
This is part of Code Pink's campaign called Women Say No to War. And we have a rally today at noon in front of the United Nations. We're calling on the UN to stand up and do something, to call for the withdrawal of U.S. troops and send in UN peacekeepers. Any New Yorkers listening, please join us at noon. And then on Wednesday, International Women's Day, we will be meeting with Congress. We're doing briefings at Congress. And we will be marching from the Iraqi embassy to the White House with our call for peace. Our call for peace is so far been signed by tens and tens of thousands of women and men around the world. And
if about 70,000?
About 70,000 to date. And if there's one thing I'd ask your listeners, Amy, to do is get online now. Go to womensaynotowar.org, whether you're a woman or a man, and sign up so we can count you in with us when we march to the Iraqi embassy, to the White House, and go through the halls of Congress turning in our urgent call for peace.
Well, we are also joined by Faiza Al-Araji, who has just come in to the United States as part of this tour. She did make it, and you came from Amman. Is that right?
Yes.
You just heard the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Peter Pace, when asked how things are going, saying they were going very well, that he wouldn't put a smiley face on it, but that things are going very well. What is your response?
I'm watching the documentary on the TV now. I'm Iraqi. I left Iraq because of the kidnapping of my son in the last summer and stay in Jordan as refugee. You know, the story when you are living there is different. It's completely different about the story your media is sending you or the message that your media is sending you. When somebody telling you that things is going on in Iraq well and everything is fine, please ask him, what is your evidence? What is your proof? What is your clue? Give me. Give me something on the ground. I can make a kind of debate. I'm ready to have a debate with the American leaders, to sit with them in front of the American people. I want to hear from them, and I will give them the answers for everything they are talking about, because we have the real story on the ground. After 3 years of evaluation, I think Iraqis have the right to talk about the evaluation of the war, not the American leaders, because we are who are suffering here, and we are... We lost the money of Iraq. We lost the souls of Iraqis. We lost the souls of loved ones in Iraq. Our kids have been kidnapped. Our neighbors have been killed. We lost everything. But what about the leaders? They are sitting in their chairs and they have the power and they have nothing. They did nothing for the Iraqi people to help the Iraqi people. I'm not telling this from my mind. It is facts on the ground.
What happened to your son?
My son was in the college. My son is it is not the only story. It is the familiar story for the Iraqi families nowadays. My son was going to the college in the morning. He finished his exam and he went to continue his operation in the office, you know, in the college. The security man faced him and he was a new one. And this new government, you know how the style of security man. He asked him, where are you going? My son was not very friendly. He asked him, it is not your work. I'm going to finish my work. I'm familiar here, and this is my college. When he finished his work with the employee and he went out, the security man stopped him. And he said, I want to open your mobile, and I want to check your identity. He said, let me see your boss. Khalid asked him, and he said, okay, you have to wait here. He was sitting to wait, and they got a bag, they put it on his head, and they arrested him and put him in the pickup and get him out of the college to the interior ministry, put him in the seventh floor, this is the zone of the terrorist people. And he saw the people were there. There were about 50 or 60 people sitting in that floor. They have been there in this room since 3 or 4 months. Their families don't know about them, if they are alive or they are dead. They have no right to contact their families. They have no right to have a lawyer. They are just suspected people. And after that, they told him that, you are innocent, we have nothing against you, but you have to tell your parents to pay money. We have to pay money to get your innocent son from their hands. And we paid thousands of dollars and get our son out of Iraq, and the whole family went out of Iraq. We closed the house, and this is the familiar story in Iraq now. Every day, stories of horrible. The life is horrible for Iraqis now. Iraq now is the hell. It is the land of hell. There is nothing. There is no electricity. There is no water. There is no security. You can't send your boy to the school because you are scared. You have to change the priority of your life. What is the priority? The education of my son or the life of him? Yes, sure, the life of my son. So the people putting their son in the houses, they will never send them to the schools or to the universities. And you can imagine what kind of life if you want to move to your job or to your school and there's curfew or there is blocks of concrete barriers for the occupation and checkpoints and checkpoints and everywhere. It is a kind of hell. You can't go out for shopping. You can't go for the hospital. Everything is destroyed in Iraq now. And this is for the services or the conditions on the ground. And what about the civil war? Somebody is pushing the country you know, to get the option of civil war. Why? Who is the benefit, Yani? The Iraqis are against civil war. If you have the chance to go to move in the streets of Iraqis and asking everyone, are you with the civil war? They will say no. Okay. If you have like official meeting with the leaders of religion and political parties and social parties and everything, they will say no. So the question is, who is pushing the country to choose the civil war? It's just to torn the society and to destroy the rest of Iraq. This is strange point, but the people thought that the only one who will benefit from this civil war is the occupation force, because it will give them the justification to stay forever in Iraq. They are building army bases to stay in Iraq. So we have no other explanation.
Faisal Al-Raji, we have to break. But when we come back, we'll continue with you as a civil engineer,
yes,
and a blogger who has informed people outside of Iraq what's going on there. We'll also be joined by Iman Khamas, who is a journalist, translator, and activist who also made it out of Baghdad. And Medea Benjamin, I want to thank you for being with us of Code Pink. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. After we speak with them, we'll be joined by Professor, Preacher, Michael Eric Dyson, author of Come Hell or High Water, Hurricane Katrina and the Color of Disaster. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue with our guests today, we're joined by Faiza Al-Raji, who is a civil engineer who's just flown in from Amman, lived in Iraq until this past summer when her son was kidnapped. We're also joined by Iman Ahmad Khamas, who is a journalist, translator, and activist, a member of the Women's Will organization. We welcome you both.
Thank you.
I asked you during the break, Faiza, are you Sunni or Shia?
I don't like this question. I'm Iraqi. And I'm insisting I'm Iraqi. I don't want to use these new titles. Have been entered Iraq after Bremer. When he entered Iraq, he put this division for the Iraqi people. And we refuse it.
What do you mean it's just been introduced? I mean, there is a sense in the media in this country that this is age-old, sectarian, almost tribal hatred.
Oh, my God. Yeah, they're trying to tell you another story. The reality is there. We are brothers and sisters. We are Muslim, my dear. This is the identity of the nation. We are Muslim. But they're trying to divide the people to go to the sub-identity, to make a cause of fighting or to provoke the people against each other. And we refuse it.
Emma?
Well, the reality is that it never happened in the history of Iraq for thousands, 6,000s of years. It never happened, a civil war or these kind of distinctions. It's true that in Iraq there are Kurds, there are Arabs and Sunnis and Shia and Christians and many other minor religions and groups. But it never happened that we fight each other, no, at all.
Yani, as Iman said yesterday, in the history there is fighting between the regime and the Kurds, or the regime against the Shia, but it doesn't mean it is civil war. It is something between, you know, for political reasons. But the media here is investing these actions to tell you another kind of stories.
I saw you both yesterday at the Community Church in New York, where you were speaking along with Medea Benjamin and Cindy Sheehan, talking about the conditions in Iraq. Iman, you have been documenting human rights abuses.
Yes.
You live in Baghdad?
I live in Baghdad.
What have you documented?
Well, I worked mainly on the bombed cities, the refugee camps. I also worked on the missing, a very big issue in Iraq now that I don't think people here have any idea about. I worked on the the detainees. These are the things that I worked on.
Missing?
The missing, yeah.
What do you mean?
Well, people disappear in Iraq. People are, especially men, are arrested, and you don't hear anything about them later. For example, in the first, in the first era of the war, between March 20 until April 9, when the Iraqi state fell down, people disappeared. There are eyewitnesses that these people were taken by the American troops. Some of them may be killed. Some of them may be in jail. But now they don't exist.
Well, how do you find out? I mean, if you want to find out if someone has been jailed, what do you do?
There are eyewitnesses in the place that he disappeared in. They say that we saw him. He was injured and was taken in an American tank or vehicle. Or he was taken. Simply. So we go to the... and there's a very important point. There are prisoners in jail who are released, and they say that in our room, the place they were in, that we have this man, and they give his description, many things that no one else would know, only the person who was with him.
The American authorities and the U.S.-run prisons will not tell you?
We go to these to the American military bases, to the prisons, and we ask about these people. They deny them.
They deny that
they exist in that prison. For example, we have a story of a man. He was supposed to be in prison in Umm Qasr, Camp Buka in the south, deep in the south.
Camp Buka is named for a fireman who was killed 9/11 in New York.
Yeah, but for Iraqis, it is a very big prison. It is a camp where tens of thousands of Iraqis are arrested for 3 years now. So people come from there and they say, we know this man, etc. And we go there. Sometimes even the American themselves, the American officials, they say yes, and they put lists of names. And when we go back, we ask about them, they say, no, we didn't do that. And we show them, I have a paper, I have a document of one of these men. And now he is denied. I don't know the number of these people. The number is between 5,000 to 15,000. But I had a meeting with a general called General Brandenburg in the Ministry of Justice, and he said that he has records of that period. And he asked me to give him the names that I'm looking for, and I did. But when we had the meeting and we had a date to go and to talk about these people, to give him the names, he did not show up, unfortunately. I'm still waiting for an answer. They said in the Ministry of Justice, they said that he's changed. Now there is another one called Gardner. But I didn't meet him yet, and I'm looking forward to meet him and to give him the lists of names and the stories of these people who disappeared. I mean, this is a very big tragedy in Iraq because there are families, mothers, wives, children who are waiting to hear about their loved ones, if they exist, if they are dead, if they are alive. They simply want answers, that's all. Only answers.
How do you even move around in Iraq?
We can move around, but it is very risky. It is very dangerous, especially if you go to dangerous places. I mean, I go, for example, to the places that are bombed, and I have faced death many times. I was almost shot many times, but it is risky. But I mean, we have to go. We have to see these people. We have to listen to them.
Even to come here, that required you traveling the road to Amman?
Yes, yes.
And you were, would the U.S. issue you the visa in Baghdad or in Amman?
No, in Amman. We don't go to the green zone. We don't go to the American embassy in Baghdad. It's inside the green zone, and they do not issue visas. You have to go to Amman to apply first, and then you have to go back to Baghdad to wait for 2, 3, 6 weeks, and then you are sent an email or you hear from them, and then you go back and you get the visa if it is granted. So this is how it works.
Faisal Araji, you are also a civil engineer.
Yes.
What about the so-called reconstruction of Iraq? We've last heard that in the upcoming budget, the only money that has been requested for reconstruction now is for prisons.
Yeah. We have heard a lot of stories about reconstruction during the 6 months or the first year after the war. And we were living inside Baghdad and watching for the, as an example, for the campaign of maintenance of the schools. We have heard about a huge budget for the contractors from Bechtel or other American companies, but the reality on the ground that the final thing that they paid from it for subcontract, then and a subcontract, an Iraqi one, he got for $2,000 for each school just to put painting and to maintain the broken glasses. This is the only thing they have done. But that maybe they are sending you the message or the story that we put new furniture and we put new computers and everything was fancy. No, this is not the truth. The reality is something very different. They, you know, I have to see a lot of or to hear about, because I'm engineer, I'm in touch with engineers and with contractors. The contractors, they are not the qualified people. If you are, I'm working with water treatment systems, and the people who are coming with the papers of the specification for the water treatment package for a village or a town, he don't know what is written in the paper. And why should they give him the contract? Why should they give him the priority? Because he is a friend of them. Because he is working in them, maybe in the military bases, building for the American military force, so they trust him and they give him the contract. He's ignorant. He don't know what is going on, what is inside the paper. And but they give him a huge amount of money. And when he come to ask me about the prices, I can give him, but I can understand. He got a big budget for this small piece. And by the time I can understand, there is a lot of money have been spent for the reconstruction of Iraq, something like this, but the reality is something on the ground, something is like this. And you buy something in this budget, but the real price is this thing. So you can see that the money of the Iraqis have been disappeared. This is a kind of, yeah, if we are talking about reconstruction and the corruption in the ministries and everywhere, it is a familiar story now. And what about the corruption of the billions of dollars of Iraqi people who have been out of the banks?
We're going to end by asking what you think the solution is to both of you.
What's the solution? What's the solution, my dear? Yeah, there is chaos. If you turn your face from this direction, there is a lot of problems in Iraq. How could you can imagine to start? What is the first step to stop all of this? The first step is help the Iraqis to have national unity government, to make a kind of reconciliation between them after the last election, to get a good government, a real government who is representative of the Iraqi people. This is step number one. Step number two, give training for the police Iraqi men and for the soldiers to help their people, not to arrest them and kill them and to campaign or to move with the American occupation force to kill Iraqi people. We need something new, strong, to trust them. And then the other step that we can ask the troops to go out, to pull out the troops from Iraq.
Iman Hamas, do you think that U.S. troops should leave immediately?
Yes. The occupation should end immediately.
What would happen then?
What would happen? Iraq would be free, would be really liberated. Iraq is now occupied.
The press describes it as it would immediately descend into civil war.
No. I mean, there are. It's not going to be like that. I mean, you have to plan it in a way that, guarantee that there will be no civil war, as you said. There is the UN, there is a Security Council, there is a peacekeeping troops. There are many things that they can work out to fill this security vacuum so that it wouldn't, as you say, go into civil war. But the occupation should end immediately. It's something wrong. It's wrong for the Iraqis, for the American, for the world, for peace, for the international law. Everything, it's wrong. It has to end now, immediately. And then, and we Iraqis, we can work things out. We are capable of that. And if we kill each other, it's our problem. It's not the Americans' problem. But I'm sure that we are capable of taking care of ourselves.
Well, we will touch base as you travel around the country in this International Women's Month, and I thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Hopefully the two other women who are supposed to be a part of your tour will also eventually make it here. I hear Mother's Day is now their goal.
Thank you.
We have been speaking with Faiza Alaraji, who is a civil engineer and blogger. Her blog, afamilyinbaghdad.blogspot.com, and we will link to it at democracynow.org. And Iman Amat Hamas, who is journalist, translator, and activist, a member of the Women's Will organization. This is Democracy Now! As we turn now, talking about issues of reconstruction, to another issue here in this country, and that is New Orleans, to the issue of race and the government's response to Hurricane Katrina. President Bush is expected to pay a visit to the Gulf Coast this week. Back in Washington, meanwhile, congressional hearings on the government response to the disaster continue. The Senate Appropriations Committee spends 2 days inspecting Bush's latest spending request for hurricane recovery. On Wednesday, the Senate Committee on Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs examines Hurricane Katrina recommendations for reform. This comes following last week's release of confidential video footage of President Bush's final briefing before Hurricane Katrina struck the Gulf Coast. It shows the president was given dire warnings the storm could breach levees and threaten the lives of residents of New Orleans. The briefing occurred on August 28th, 1 day before Hurricane Katrina hit. On the video, President Bush is seen watching the briefing via a video conference from his Texas ranch at Crawford. The president does not ask a single question throughout the briefing, yet concludes with this optimistic response.
I want to assure the folks at the state level that we are fully prepared to not only help you during the storm, but we will move in whatever resources and assets we have at our disposal after the storm to help you deal with the loss of property, and we pray for no loss of life, of course.
Days later, President Bush said he hadn't, the breach of the levees hadn't been anticipated. The release of the video came as Bush's approval rating is at an all-time low. A new CBS News poll has found the number of Americans who approve of President Bush's overall job performance is just 34%. Less than a third of Americans believe the president has adequately responded to the needs of the victims of Hurricane Katrina. In the days after the storm hit, Bush made a pledge to the residents of the devastated city of New Orleans.
Tonight, so many victims of the hurricane and the flood are far from home and friends and familiar things. You need to know that our whole nation cares about you. And in the journey ahead, you're not alone. To all who carry a burden of loss, I extend the deepest sympathy of our country. To every person who has served and sacrificed in this emergency, I offer the gratitude of our country. And tonight, I also offer this pledge of the American people. Throughout the area hit by the hurricane, we will do what it takes. We will stay as long as it takes to help citizens rebuild their communities and their lives. And all who question the future of the Crescent City need to know, there is no way to imagine America without New Orleans. And this great city will rise again.
President Bush speaking last September. 6 months later, much of New Orleans remains obliterated, the city struggling to rebuild. In the aftermath of the hurricane, the government's response to the disaster came under heavy criticism. During a nationally televised telethon days after Katrina hit, hip-hop artist Kanye West broke away from his scripted comments with comedian Mike Myers.
I hate the way they portray us in the media. If you see a black family, it says they're looting. See a white family, it says they're looking for food. And you know it's been 5 days because most of the people are black And even for me to complain about, I would be a hypocrite because I've tried to turn away from the teacher TV because it's too hard to watch. We already realize a lot of the people that could help are at war right now, fighting another way, and they've given them permission to go down and shoot us.
And subtle, but in even many ways more profoundly devastating, is the lasting damage to the survivors' will to rebuild and remain in the area. The destruction of the spirit of the people of southern Louisiana and Mississippi may end up being the most tragic loss of all.
George Bush doesn't care about black people.
Yes, that was Kanye West for a look at the government response to Hurricane Katrina. We'll go after break to professor preacher Michael Eric Dyson, who's written the book Come Hell or High Water, Hurricane Katrina and the Color of Disaster. Stay with us.
Weasel droppings on a flooded skyline. Gas and foam from the tabloid byline. Waiters and getters, goiters and betters, corporate bedwetters, all eaters and abettors. Spin their story of Storyville City, where the folks is happy and the jazz so pretty. America dreams on an oily lake, golden goose step, for Jesus' sake. Department of sleepwalk and binary small talk. Cakewalk in the water to attend the wake.
Notable notables keeping score. Donut holes on the ballroom floor. K Street paid to handle the door. For the donut holes on the ballroom floor. You don't hear what you say.
Duck by Polarity here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. We are broadcasting on over 400 stations around the country, on Pacifica and NPR and low power FM and college and community radio stations, as well as on public access TV and PBS TV stations and both TV satellite networks, Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV Channel 375. And we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. You can also find the transcripts of every day's broadcast there. I'm Amy Goodman. We are joined by Professor Preacher Michael Eric Dyson, Professor of Humanities at the University of Pennsylvania, an ordained Baptist minister, author of a number of books. His latest is Come Hell or High Water, Hurricane Katrina and the Color of Disaster. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you with us, and congratulations on your new radio show that
Thank
you're
you
doing
so
daily.
Thank you so very kindly. I appreciate that.
So I appreciate you coming up from Philadelphia. Talk about the color of disaster.
Well, I think that what we saw revealed in Hurricane Katrina was a spectacle of disaster, a disaster colored by race, by class, by poverty, issues that the administration and the American people, to a frightening degree, have neglected. But this administration's ineptitude, its inexperience, its ignorance, combined with this chronic cronyism, led to the sight of mostly poor black people on television, but we know it was more broad than that, being left to their own devices. And that was only a metaphor, unfortunately, of the way in which they had been left behind long ago by administrations, black and white, which had refused to combat the chronic forms of health care that they were lacking, the poverty that they endured. 134,000 people in New Orleans were without cars. They weren't stuck. They weren't stupid or stubborn. They were stuck. And so I think that this hurricane washed to the fore what we all knew was there.
Describe for us New Orleans before Katrina.
Well, before Katrina, you know, Louisiana is the second poorest state in the nation. Mississippi is first, so that Gulf Coast, and then Alabama is not too far behind. 134,000 people there without cars, transportation, a lot of people without health care, many elderly people and young people who were part of those numbers. The underemployment and unemployment was devastating. The rate of dropouts among African-American people was very high. And beyond that, they were shifted mostly from schools, which were holding pens for prison, to Angola Prison, where some of them would die.
So, and explain Angola Prison.
Well, Angola Prison is a former plantation, still a plantation, where many people are sent and to serve in what we would see as Middle Ages conditions. It is really a bleak and devastating scene for those who are sent, often for nonviolent drug offenses, to a prison where they are held, and many of them die there. It is one of the worst prisons in America, and certainly one of the most devastating indications that we have warehoused poor people in conditions that punish them for their poverty as opposed to relieving it.
Those are the prisons, the economic and the health care of the people there even before Katrina, right. And then we'll talk about after.
Right, right. Well, you're absolutely right. The economic conditions of poor people there were most atrocious. These people are making minimum wage or less. Many of them are working in the service industry. They are providing relief. Remember, George Bush went down there, wink, wink. I came down here and had a bunch of fun. Well, who was changing your bed sheets? Who was providing the opportunity for the relief that you felt? Many of those poor people were invisible, as Michael Harrington would argue a few decades ago. And they were subject to the worst forms of, cronyism that was already at place in New Orleans. And Mayor Ray Nagin, though he has been remade as a working class hero, certainly was called Ray Reagan because of his conservative politics. He crossed party lines and supported Bobby Jindal, who's now a Republican congressman there, against Kathleen Babineau Blanco for her run for the governor. So this guy is not exactly screaming leftist, and he came out of the business entrepreneur field as Cox Cable vice president to run New Orleans. And here was a man who allowed 1,000 seats on an Amtrak train to go empty to Mississippi. No one on. We saw the buses
drown.
Well, what happened is that Amtrak called up and said, look, we got nearly 1,000 seat train empty, a dumbhead train, they call it, running from New Orleans to higher ground in Mississippi to take some equipment, and we want to put people on. His office turned them down. Right before it hit, so it could have gotten people out of there. He turned them down. You saw the buses drown infamously. Mayor Nagin was called at Saturday. That is, the hurricane hit early Monday morning. Saturday at 6 o'clock by the head of the weather service. This is the worst hurricane I've ever seen. I want to go to bed with a good conscience. Please get these people out. He thought about it overnight. He consulted with the business community because he didn't want to be legally liable for any suits filed by them were he to call a mandatory evacuation. And they said, well, say, for instance, Hyatt Regency or some other company said, you put us out of business or you tamp down on our business. So it was that kind of ridiculous messing with the people's future, so to speak, that is quite tragic. He cursed the Bush administration out and others later on. That was a remarkable moment of political lucidity. But for the most part, I think he fumbled along with the federal government. And the federal government, if he was bad, they were much worse.
Well, let's talk about the federal government's mm-hmm. response. We were just playing the clip of the video conference that President Bush had before Hurricane Katrina hit, where he didn't ask a question.
Then
headed off Monday and Tuesday to San Diego, to Arizona, to celebrate Senator McCain's birthday.
Exactly.
What about the administration's response? Where were you as you were watching this?
Yeah, well, I'm watching like everybody else, glued to the television. But it's atrocious. President Bush literally eating cake. It's a reversal of that let them eat cake. I guess he and McCain ate their own. And then the San Diego Padres game was attended by, Donald Rumsfeld. Condoleezza Rice buying Ferragamo shoes here famously in New York while her people drowned. Her people, she's from Birmingham, Alabama. No incentive for her to reach out and say, maybe we should do something about this situation. And the past she's been given by black people to me is unforgivable because her politics have put her at odds with the fundamental impulse toward freedom and justice and at least fairness that we've celebrated. So the Bush administration was awful in its response immediately and then collectively. Michael Brown, though he has been made a scapegoat, to be sure, and I thankfully point this out in my book, but he was incompetent. The head of the International Arabian Horse Association. Yeah, it sounds like a real recommendation to head FEMA. Joseph Alba, who was his predecessor, had no experience. Out of the Bush campaign in 2000, he went into that office. They allowed 60 countries to you know, turned them down basically for help. They also allowed people, 500 firemen came down looking to be helpful. What were they done? What did they do? They passed out leaflets with 1-800 numbers for FEMA. They were outraged and pulled off their FEMA shirts and said, we'll not serve with them. USS Bataan, a big ship with hundreds of beds that could have given 100,000 potable gallons of water every day. Nothing was called upon except one helicopter. Black Hawk helicopters down there transferring the media to the site, but nothing else. So we missed a great opportunity. It's not that we didn't have the ability to do so. It's that they failed to do so because they had no experience. And plus, let's be honest, this was a government that believes that the government is the enemy of the people. I mean, George Bush is the child of Ronald Reagan. And it just amazes me. The people who hate the government the most want to run it. But they get in charge, and then they try to downsize it, but they've expanded it in deleterious fashion. But beyond that, they failed to use the bureaucracy in defense of the people. I mean, Jim Carroll in Boston argues if the people own the government and the government represents the people, then the government helping the people is self-help. And this government just doesn't understand it. This administration certainly doesn't comprehend that.
You talk in the book about what was happening to people in mm-hmm. New Orleans. You right. have a quote of Darnell Harrington, a Katrina yes. survivor.
Yeah.
Talk about what happened to him.
Yeah, well, this young man, and I've met, it was just an amazing young man, 26 years old, a quite gifted rapper as well. But he's a worker down there, and he's walking, and suddenly he feels burning in his chest and realizes he's been shot by buckshot in the front from his neck down on his chest. He falls on the ground, rises back up to try to walk again, and is shot in his back. Remarkably, he survives. His cousin runs off. He goes to several houses trying to get help. They turn him down, mostly white people. He saw a black man. He tried to go to him for help. He said, the black man said, come on in. But there was a white woman in his house who said, you got to get out of here. I can't help you. He had to go back out. He saw two white gentlemen in a truck. He went up to them. Please, please help me. They used the N-word on him and said, we're liable to kill you ourselves, so get out of our faces. Then he found a white woman in a house, I think with a black family, who took him in and who lied because the guys who had shot him came looking for him. And they lied and said he wasn't there.
And who had shot him?
And these two white gentlemen. And they were like trying to get the Negroes with the, I don't know if we can use that word on your show, trying to get them out. And they said, we're trying to kill these black people because the media had drummed up the notion that these black people were anarchic and down here doing all devastating manner of things. So the reality is that the media, ironically enough, celebrating its own self, patting its own self on the back for being liberatory, had, reinforced some of the prevailing stereotypes about black people down there. As it turns out, only 10 people were dead, only one from homicide, not this 200 and 300 people we thought, not young people raping 7-year-old babies and so on. I'm sure rape, which is an underreported crime under any condition, certainly occurred there. So I'm not dismissing that, but not to the degree that was suggested and not with the kind of barbaric intensity that was prefigured in the media. So these white guys were saying, we're getting rid of the niggas, and that's what we're doing, and we're looking for this guy, and they shot him. And his story is quite remarkable because there are many more stories like that. They didn't come to the fore, although I think the major racial response was not of that ilk. It was of the ilk that said, the same racial framework that allows us to look for Natalie Holloway when she disappears, but when Tamika Houston disappears, there's nobody looking for her. That's the same racial framework. It's a collective unconscious. It's a set of racial cues that suggests what's important, what's not important, who should be looked at, who should not be looked at. I think if a nation of a camera full of Barbara Bushes were down there drowning in New Orleans, it's not that the incompetence of the government could have been any way tamped down upon immediately, but they might have tried harder. And I think that's the issue of race in this particular situation. The black people did not spawn an intuitive response by either the government. And this is a Southern racial narrative to me. Michael Brown from Oklahoma, George Bush, Texas bred, black people from Mississippi, Louisiana, and Alabama. It's a Southern racial narrative playing itself out on a global stage. And I think we saw the vicious politics of the collective of racial imagination of the South, which has no tolerance, as one historian put it, either for black pain or black suffering on the one hand, or black agency of success on the other. Both of them are obliterated in the Southern imagination, and we saw that down in Hurricane Katrina.
We're talking to Michael Eric Dyson, professor of humanities at the University of Pennsylvania, author of come hell or high water, Hurricane Katrina and the color of disaster. His book before that is Bill Cosby Right. Can you make a link between the two?
Yeah, well, I think this book is a continuation of that. In a new book, I have another new book out called Pride, The Seven Deadly Sins, where I take up issues, but I'll speak
Are
about
Are you writing
it.
A book as you're sitting here? You write so many books.
I should write a book on you. I mean, you're a phenomenal woman. So the Bill Cosby book is a book that addresses Bill Cosby's vicious and vituperative remarks about poor black people and his diss of them. And I tried to take up the cudgel he threw down at them and used it to reshape it into a defense, a hammer on the anvil of political consciousness to say, wait a minute, let's shape this in a different way. You don't have to beat up on poor people. You don't have to dog them, talk about the names they give their kids, beat up on poor people on welfare. It really was an attack on women. I think about this Women's History Month. Mr. Cosby's assault was really basically on poor black women and how they allowed their kids to buy gym shoes and sneakers and not hooked on phonics and so on, taking small snippets of anecdotal experience to fashion a political assault upon them that was ill-founded. So I tried to prove how ill-founded it was.
So this was in response to Bill Cosby saying
yes.
What?
He said that basically black people who are poor have not held up their end of the bargain in the civil rights movement. And he didn't say it that nicely. He went on and on and on using negative these people, this clinically dispassionate language for poor black people, pointing the finger at them, suggesting that they were incapable of joining the mainstream of America precisely because they were anti-intellectual, uneducated, and disinclined to do anything serious about their lives. And then I tried to say, look, it's a lot more than personal responsibility. I think personal responsibility is critical, but it's one wing of the plane, so to speak. The other wing he never speaks about, social injustice, political impediments to flourishing of poor black people, the condition of their lives when they're born. How about the perpetuation of a legacy of injustice that is economically driven that he never speaks about? How about big corporations for which he is shielded mercilessly, who create desire in young people to have stuff like gym shoes that he might have come along and been a person who promoted them had he come along right now?
And the links to Katrina and the response to it?
I think in many ways, the same black people who felt that Cosby was right, Shaniqua, Taliqua, as he used their names, and he says they're all in jail. Well, if you believe that, you believe the people in Katrina basically got what they deserve. Poor people who don't work hard, who don't get up every morning to do what they're supposed to do, basically get what they deserve. It sounds vicious, but I think that's the logical leap. The link also is that Mr. Cosby let off any segment of conscientious white America about its own role and responsibility in what we saw down there. And again, the government, especially the Bush administration, might have taken the Cosby approach. Look, this is the consequence of what people do. This is, had you worked harder and gotten a way out, didn't Bill O'Reilly say on television, look at this scene. And when you see this, young people realize this. If you don't get an education, this is what will happen to you.
Professor Dyson, we only have a minute left.
Yes.
President Bush is headed to the Gulf Coast this week.
Yeah.
We saw Mardi Gras kind of take place this week, a very different New Orleans, not the African-American city that we're used to.
Yeah,
what do you think has to happen?
Well, I mean, the reconstruction has to pay attention to the Ninth Ward and to poor people there. The higher ground will always be rebuilt. The lower ground will always suffer. The lower ground and higher ground has always been racially segregated and class-driven. What we have to do is make sure that the reconstruction of the New Orleans happens with the input of the people who are there. There are some very progressive groups there who have already, before the storm, put forth arguments about how New Orleans should be the demographics should be spread out and the resources should be given to those poorer people. Those voices need to be heard in order for New Orleans to come back anywhere near the demographic integrity it had before the storm.
Well, Professor Michael Eric Dyson, I want to thank you for being with us again. His new book is Come Hell or High Water, Hurricane Katrina and the Color of Disaster. And that does it for today's broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, John Hamilton, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Maddie Harper, Aaron Mate. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. We fly out today to London, where we'll be broadcasting the show for the next few days. And for suggestions of people to interview and issues to cover there, you can email us at mail, M-A-I-L, at democracynow.org. You can also go to our website for the video and audio podcast and look forward to seeing folks in the New York area on March 18th at Cooper Union. We'll be spending the evening with Harry Belafonte. That's at Cooper Union. Go to our website for the details at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.